everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of the Media Voices podcast. I'm your host, Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston.
We have one topic in particular that we're dying to talk about this week. But before then, Peter, who did you talk to?
This week, I spoke to Rafat Ali. He's a co-founder and CEO of boutique travel publisher Skift. We spoke about what connects the dots between paid content, travel, dining and wellness. We spoke about his belief in trend lines, not headlines. His long-term aspirations for Skift versus short-term VC plays. And why he wants to ultimately be useless in his business.
Nice. But just before we get into the news proper, we want to remind you that we're writing a report. So Media Voices team is actually putting together a report, and we're having a launch event in London on the 13th of November. There is an RSVP link in our newsletter. Please do come along. We'd love to meet some of you in person and also share the results of our first ever report. Before that, though, the news, and we want to talk about something that is headlined the stupid Waitrose vegan thing by one of you in the news roundup. So Esther, why don't you take the audience through exactly what happened this week?
Sorry, yeah. So for those of you that aren't on Twitter, if you are, you can't possibly have escaped this. But for those of you that aren't on Twitter, you'll have missed the tsunami of opinions. The editor of Waitrose magazine, William Sitwell, has quit after responding to a pitch from Celine Nelson, who is a vegan freelancer. So she pitched him a series of plant-based meals. Sounds sensible, you know, Waitrose magazine, that's straight up their street. But he replied saying instead they should do a series on killing vegans one by one. Ways to trap them, ways to expose their hypocrisy, make them eat steak and red wine.
He sounds like...
Over to you guys.
Yeah. Well, off the bat, I mean, he sounds like one hell of a guy. You know, as you mentioned, the best man for Jacob Rees-Mogg. Peter, you say this is the most British story ever. What do you mean by that?
Just everything wrapped up in it. Absolutely everything. There's the whole posh boy class white privilege thing. There's bullying at work. There's the PC versus vegan type thing. It's just everything in one story. It really is a story that keeps on giving.
I was thinking about this before we started recording, and to me it really did seem to be, initially the story seemed to be completely inconsequential. It seemed to be nothing. It seemed to be less than a puff of hot air. But then you start looking into it and you think, well, actually, there is so much to unpack here. Everything you've said and sort of examinations about what the responsibilities of, you know, branded content and being an editor of a magazine are. And then you look deeper and you go, oh, no, wait, it's nothing again. It's a nothing story again.
It's probably worth saying at this point that this has basically exploded on Twitter this week, and you've got people separating into the camps of, oh, everybody's being a snowflake, nobody can make a joke anymore, you're being fired over a joke. You've then got the camp that's like, you can't talk to people like that. There's then the, you can't talk to vegans like that. Imagine if it said that about Jews. You've just got this whole, like, everybody has got like an outrage opinion. You've got people like Jacob Rees-Mogg wading in and saying, oh, this is a man that's like lost his job over a bad joke. And the most
Jacob Rees-Mogg's a bad joke.
But the most weird and unexpected people have been wading in about this online. It's quite strange. Like the editor of Press Gazette, Dominic Ponsford, just said, oh, this. PR people should be grateful to ever get a response from editors, which I thought was just awful.
But she's not a PR. She's a freelancer. And I'm all for.
Oh my God. She should have been grateful. He said she should have been killed.
That's literally what he said.
Oh my.
Do you know what? We need to walk this back from the very worst part of this. We need to walk back to the stupid parts of this. The worst part about this, being slightly serious for a second, anyone that thinks it's funny at this time in human history to suggest that any group, however much you disagree with them or think they're silly, should be killed is a fucking moron.
Yeah, agreed.
I mean, we could just leave that there.
Yeah, but let's not. So I think that walking it back still, there's this whole idea that I saw Dom Ponsford explicitly, you know, express this opinion, that this is another victory for, you know, Twitter hate groups. This, to me, seems like a completely bizarre opinion. A, because nobody comes out of this situation the victor. We are losers by association now, even for discussing it. But also the idea that the people who've campaigned for him to lose the job, I've not actually seen any evidence of that, are the ones who are in some way the aggressor here. Like, it's ridiculous. Waitrose magazine is effectively a piece of branded content. They are launching a new vegan range. this to me seems to be completely against the commercial interests of what is explicitly a commercial proposition. This is not, as has been pointed out, the NYT. This isn't the paper of record. You know, this is Waitrose magazine.
I mean, that's the point. I don't think this went on long enough for that to be a campaign for him to be fired.
He resigned as well.
He quit.
We should probably mention that.
I put a tweet out seeing the original story, and I just said, "Oh, that escalated quickly." And the next thing I knew, he wasn't the editor anymore. So it escalated even quicker. And I think the point is John Brown does this on behalf of Waitrose.
Mm.
So you've got two commercial entities going, what are we going to do with this? It's not just Waitrose. It's always the client relationship that John Brown had.
Well, yeah, what ties into that, and you know, I know there's like political stuff, there's class stuff, there's all sorts going on in this, but I think it boils down to something even simpler, that if I hired somebody like that in a professional context and they spoke like that to anybody, especially somebody external, I'd fire them from professional conduct. Like, just be nice to people. And I think it kind of probably says a lot about who he is and the culture he's come out, that you think it's acceptable to talk to people like that.
See, there we go, though. We're straight back into that British thing, the culture that he came out of. What school did he go to, people?
Did he go to Eton?
Why is he friends with Jacob Rees-Mogg?
Yeah.
You know, it's like
estates are next to each other, I don't know.
It's like all the stuff about the way people like Philip Green treat people. Like you cannot in this day and age treat people like garbage. You can't shout at them. You can't scream at them. You can't call them abusive things. You can't threaten to kill them. that's just a normal like standard of human behaviour now.
Yeah, it's just to kind of wrap up, I suppose, it's bizarre that what should have been basically a non-story, you know, a commercial magazine lost its editor because of something he said, quickly did become this flashpoint for discussions around, you know, white male privilege, you know, kind of these old monsters who aren't suited for the modern day anymore. And honestly, yeah, I think Esther's right. It just boils down to, don't be a dick. Why would you ever want to anyway?
Yeah. Meat-based stupidity.
Yeah. Moving on then, Channel 4 has picked Leeds as its national headquarters. Now, Leeds wasn't necessarily one of the front runners. It's given a couple of people pause. It's given a couple of people a pleasant surprise. So, Esther, why do you think this is a good idea?
Oh, I think this is great because it's so hard if you're in media to actually look outside London for jobs. And I'm really hoping this will kind of say to people, actually, that there is life outside the M25 bubble. You know, if you want to move somewhere that's more reasonably priced, that you get a better quality of life in that sense, there's now like a good option. Not that there aren't great companies outside of London, but it's not kind of where the action happens. And I think for Channel 4 to decentralise a little bit is really, really good.
I think this is good as well. I think it's brilliant. I think anything that takes jobs out of London and puts them elsewhere in the country is good. Anything that makes people inside London realise that there are actually places outside of London is good. Going back to our original conversation, I can imagine the posh boys going, Leeds? Where the f***ing hell is Leeds? How do you get there? So, yeah, I think this is brilliant. Selfishly, I wish it had gone to Manchester because that's closer to me. But now Leeds is great. And it's not just AHQ that's going to Leeds. They're also opening new creative hubs in Glasgow and Bristol, which is brilliant.
Yeah,
I think I've only been in Leeds once, but it seemed like quite a nice place.
I went
apparently
on a...
pints are £2.50 in Leeds.
Well, relatedly,
pints are £2.50 in the real world, Esther.
Yeah.
The only place pints are not £2.50 is in city centres and London.
Yeah, I went on a stag do in Leeds, and because of that, I got absolutely hammered very, very early on. But yeah, you're right. Anything that pricks this kind of London media bubble is a good thing.
Cool. Although maybe the posh boy density will increase in London.
God.
Because everyone else will go somewhere else.
So this next one, to be completely honest, is a story that I completely missed. So I'm going to rely on one of the two of you to explain this to me. The UK and Canadian governments have united to try and pin down Zuckerberg. This is presumably a further effort to haul him in over the coals about what disinformation and quote-unquote fake news.
Basically, yeah. So do you remember back in April when Congress hauled Zuckerberg up?
Mm-hmm.
Britain were like, oh, actually, yeah, we want to do the same. We want to have him over to the UK. And it was really awkward because he completely ignored us, which then led to us, like, we didn't quite take that step, but we were then like, well, if you set foot in the UK, you're then in contempt of Parliament. So he was like, okay,
oh, they actually did that?
I don't think they actually issued that call, but they basically gave up. So now the only way to try and get him over we've united with Canada. And you're spotless here. Organisers have called this hearing that they want to hold at the end of the month the International Grand Committee on Disinformation and Fake News. I thought last week we're not allowed to call it that anymore. But anyway, for some reason, that's what we're calling it. It's going to be held in Westminster at the end of the month. The government have said if representatives of any other governments around the world that want to speak to Zuckerberg want to pitch in, please turn up. Oh, and Damien Collins and the Canadian MP Bob Zimmer signed a letter saying, you know, the hearing of your evidence is now overdue and urgent. So is Zuckerberg going to attend?
No. This is so toothless.
This is a very practical thing, isn't it? It's like, instead of going around the 56 different countries that I've got a problem with here, he just goes to one place.
I see. So it's a law. We've set the trap and we're trying to get him in there just because they can get everything out of the way in one go.
I mean, maybe he'll send Nick Clegg.
Well, at least Clegg would be able to find the room very easily.
Yeah, even if he couldn't find his arse with both hands.
I don't know. We're going to have to keep an eye on that. It sounds like at the end of the month, I'll eat this Cookie Monster onesie I'm wearing right now if he actually turns up and gives deposition. But there's also more Facebook news this week. So, Esther, you're very angry about the fact it's shifting focus from its feed to stories.
So there came a statement out from Zuckerberg this week, spot the parallels, that he said all of the stories trends suggest that in the not-too-distant future, people will be sharing more stories than they will into feeds. And this is almost exactly what he said about video at the start of the year. I mean, we're literally like not even 10 months on. And again, like a lot of people on Twitter are saying, this doesn't feel like right, like our friends aren't using stories. And I think it's that case exactly again. People said in January, wait, we don't see people watching or sharing much video. Don't listen to him. Don't believe him. This is literally just down to making it an easy sell for advertisers.
I love the idea that effectively after this one, everyone's going to go, you don't know what the hell's happening on your platform, do you? You're just making bad bets constantly. He's going to look like a fool.
But it's not really like he's making bad bets, is it? It's like he's trying to game the table.
But he is the table. He is the casino. Well, exactly.
There's an interesting piece. Farhad Manjoo did a piece this week talking about, basically the question was, should Zuckerberg leave Facebook or stop running Facebook? And the answer was very quickly no. Everyone except Esther says no. and his point, I don't know whether I agree with him or I agree with Esther, but his point was Zuckerberg broke it and he's the only person that has a broad enough and a deep enough view to fix it.
Oh, come on, that's like saying if you point Boris Johnson's prime minister, you can fix Brexit.
Jesus Christ. Oh, I know it's the Halloween special, but come on.
But that idea that only the person that broke it can fix it, I don't agree with that at all.
No,
I'm not sure.
But the same time, if you depose Zuckerberg, who takes his place? Is it the case of, you know, you get rid of one evil and a greater one comes in its place? I think there's one more thing that's worth mentioning when it comes to Facebook, and that's that in the budget this week, the UK government are looking to hit Google, Facebook and Amazon with a digital service tax. And I get this, like, we're completely out of time to go into that, but we'll include some links in the newsletter. We may even include the incomprehensible diagram that they released.
Oh, my God, did you see that thing?
It was hilarious.
I haven't seen that.
Oh, you've got to see it.
I can't wait for the newsletter this week.
The worst depiction of digital services you will ever see. But my big fear is that our tech illiterate government genuinely thinks that three links computers with a couple of like silhouettes of people underneath and a couple of mobile phones stuck in is the
dotted lines.
And dotted lines is the depiction of the internet, and it scares the hell out of me. So we didn't have time to discuss all the following stories in full, but we're going to include links to them in our newsletter, and maybe we'll go into them at a later date. So, Trusted Reviews of TI Media has donated £1 million to charity after publishing leaked information about the current biggest game in the world, Red Dead Redemption 2, and literally none of it makes sense to me. They didn't break any rules. The only thing I can think is they're buckling under the threat of a lawsuit.
The failing New York Times has gained more than 200,000 digital subscribers in Q3, 60,000 of them, not for news, but for crosswords and recipes. So there are a total of 3 million digital subscribers, 4 million in total, and their operating profits are up 30%. So get it up, you Mr. Donald Trump.
A bunch of media organisations are preparing material for Snap's shows, which launched a couple of weeks ago. So Sky, The Guardian, Channel 4, Vice and 13 more are apparently working original and reworked programming for Snapchat's new vertical TV offering. And funny enough, this is because of advertising. But to me, this seems a bit an odd thing to do, given that Snapchat has lost 5 million users since their redesign in Q2, and many other media organizations are pulling back.
Additionally, Vice Media is nearing profitability, says its CEO, Nancy Dubuc, and Condé Nast is launching Vogue Hong Kong.
We're now able to offer transcripts of our interviews thanks to our partnership with Trint. They have a really cool AI automated transcription tool for audio and video. Look out for details both about them and the transcripts in our weekly newsletter, or get in touch with us if you'd like to be added to an exclusive email list that goes out every Monday with the transcript.
This week I spoke to Skiff CEO Rafa Ali about his boutique media philosophy, his long-term view of Skift versus short-term venture-funded media plays. But first, I asked him about the origins of the Bloomberg of travel, Skift.
We started Skift in the summer of 2012, so it's about 6.5 years now. Started originally as the Bloomberg of travel, as the shorthand, which is the fastest way to explain it. News, research, data, conferences for the travel industry, and travel between all its different subsectors, airlines, hospitality, tourism, etc., is by many accounts one of the world's largest industries. So we thought that we could create a vertical business media brand that talks about the business of travel in a big picture way. And that original premise is essentially the same premise that we have 6.5 years later. Obviously, we've become the largest news source in the travel industry globally. And we've moved just in the last year and a half, moved beyond the business of travel into the business of dining. Skift Table is our brand. We bought a small newsletter that we rebranded. We covered the business of restaurants and dining. And then just about a month ago, we launched Skift Wellness, which is the business of wellness. Modern wellness has completely changed beyond what historically used to be the spas, etc. And now it's pretty much everything from food to clothing to housing, etc. Everything is now, wellness has become a big part of it. So we think we're one of the first vertical media companies to focus on the business of wellness. So travel, dining, and wellness, I guess the business of leisure would be the umbrella. And we are almost 60 people now. Most of us based here in the US, 2 based in the UK, 2 in Singapore. We just hired to start our Asia expansion. And about 20 more hires next year in 2019.
Oh,
so.
Wow.
So we're growing fast, obviously, all of it organically.
What's the trajectory that took you to Skift?
Well, so very short, because obviously, you know, I could go on for the whole day talking about this, but I'm technically a British Indian American now, and was a computer engineer by schooling that hated programming back when the developers were the rock stars that they are today. Moved into advertising, copywriting, thought that would be very cool, just to sort of the Mad Men divisions in my head. And then pretty much that, this was back in India. They moved into PR, got exposed to the journalists writing about media, and then I said that's what I wanted to do. And then so I jumped into my first job in journalism was B2B media. So I've been a lifer in B2B media, which is a rarity in general for people. Started writing about the business of advertising for a magazine in India, and then moved to US, did my master's here, stayed here. Started blogging back in, really when I first moved here, which is 1999. Initially started personal blogging, just me as an Indian, as a foreigner in Indiana, experience, you know, learning about America for the first time. And so I got hooked onto blogging from there, started paid content, which was the previous company that many of people in the media industry remember, and that became one of the first media companies to come out of the blogging world. I started paidcontent.org in June 2002. I think Gawker started a couple of months after. So we were one of the first two companies. So Gawker took the blog model and stretched it in a consumer direction. I took it and then stretched it in a sort of business media direction. And paid content for, you know, many of you remember, from a solo blog to multiple people, started covering all kinds of things beyond just paid content. It became about the business of media.
Yeah.
And covered US pretty heavily, UK pretty heavily as well, some other European, then India. We also covered mobile. We were early covering the mobile media business. And then, as many of you remember, I sold it, sold the company to Guardian in 2008, and then left in 2010, and then took a two-year break, and then started this in 2012 with my co-founder, Jason Clampett, who's the editor of Skift. So,
can you draw, is there a line, if you like, between paid content and Skift?
There is. One, obviously, both of them are vertical business media companies, meaning focused on a specific sector. But beyond that, both in at paid content and at Skift, they cover a very large, both of them cover a very large sector with different silos in it that historically haven't necessarily been seen together. So paid content, back when it started in 2002, was looking at the business of media, information and entertainment industries. And historically, you know, back then it wasn't obvious why the newspaper should be looking at the music industry, what was happening. Obviously, you know, 15 years later, it's blindingly obvious why they should have looked at it. So connecting the dots across seemingly separate industries in a larger sector is an expertise that we developed at paid content. It's a very similar expertise that we have at Skift, which is the separate industries of airlines, hospitality, tourism, cruises, tech, etc., we've mashed together and connected dots across them because the consumers don't care about these separations. And it was very similar with paid content. So I think connecting the dots across these relatively separate industries is what the through line is.
Do you have to have a different kind of person working for you, someone that understands the broader industry rather than someone who has a very specific beat?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things that I evangelize internally as well as externally is the big picture. There's always, if you think the story is at a certain level, chances are the story is actually at two levels higher. It always has to fit into a larger narrative arc. And people, and this is what I, you know, I'm not hands-on with editorial anymore, obviously paid content. I was editorial. Skift early on, I was more involved in editorial, and even now, on and off, I jump in to set the themes and the larger voice. But it's always about where does this fit into the larger narrative of what we're covering, and that there has to be a multi-year arc of why we're doing what we're doing. So in travel, that is the big push for us. You know, we've been covering themes for the last 5 years that we continue to cover.
So that is that idea that you're giving people. You're not just saying, here's how you do this little tiny aspect of your job. You're saying, here's the industry that you work in, guys, and here's how you can maybe do a better job by understanding what other people are doing.
Yeah, I think that, so we internally, we have this thing called the editorial canvas that has, you know, it breaks down, it's actually a document that breaks down evergreen themes we're covering. It breaks down yearly themes we're covering. So it does have a point of view. Like one of the big things that we say is that we're building a business around trend lines, not headlines.
Oh yeah.
You know, it's not an original phrase. I think Bill Clinton used it in the past in different contexts, but that's kind of us trying to figure out what the trend lines of the world are in travel, hopefully now in the dining space, and hopefully at some point, you know, deeper into the wellness space.
Yeah. You on your Twitter profile, you've got a pinned tweet that talks about the hiring promise that you make to people. And you talk about being the best boutique media company to work for on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by boutique?
Yeah, so certainly this has been a very popular tweet and an amazing hiring tool for us, as you can imagine. And it's aspirational in many ways. I mean, it's one of those North Stars that at some point will, you know, we may never reach, but we continue to work towards it. So boutique for us means a very human, high touch, artisanal company, to use some of the hipster phrases, I suppose. and always have a human face to the company. As you can, you know, I'm out there, a very human face for the company, and coming at it to use a cliche, a more authentic point of view that then is not just me, but everyone else at the company. It shows in our coverage. It shows in our, especially at our conferences, what we call forums that we do, which people always say, you know, we're not a very formal, buttoned up company, and you know, we wear our faults pretty openly.
Right.
I think that, you know, that sense of vulnerability that we show to our readers, audiences, or users, whatever you want to call it, helps us a lot, because they then feel a genuine connection to us. So in many ways, and obviously we're in the hot, you know, we cover the business of hospitality, so we understand the boutique hotel world. And in many ways, I'm borrowing some of these elements, we are borrowing some of these elements from there, which is this independent boutique streak that, you know, hoteliers started, I would say, you know, as a phenomena. It started back in the late 70s to early 80s as a phenomena. We have studied that deeply in our coverage, and I'm taking some of those elements and applying it in a media context.
In a media context, and I guess even in a hotel context, is that boutique idea in sort of direct, not conflict necessarily, but a direct reaction to the opposite, which I guess is big corporate?
Yeah, I mean, my whole existence has been about existing outside the mainstream. And I think that is something that we embrace at Skift as well. I think fiercely independent is probably the right phrase. We always want to be seen as fiercely independent in the company, and be able to say what we think is the right thing, and always be on the right side of history. I mean, this is, we're going a little deeper here, but but I think that, you know, we are a progressive company, and progressive in the most expansive meaning of that word. And we embrace progressive ideals that may or may not be political. And so that comes across in our company and how we look at the world.
One of the other things I've seen you say recently on Twitter, you say, my main job is to make myself useless to the companies I help start.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
So I think that personality-led media paid content was certainly... It started as a blog. Many of those early blog companies were, you know, whether it was TechCrunch or GigaOm or a bunch of others that were started, Gawker to a large extent, initially at least, were very personality-led media companies. That many of them flamed out for, you know, when the founder couldn't scale themselves. And if I'm trying to build a long-lasting company, which with Skift, I definitely am, paid content lasted 11 years, which I suppose is long enough in the blog world, but Skift obviously wanted to be a very long-lasting company. So so it has to, it can't be a personality-led company. And in general, founders' main jobs, this is especially true in media, is to make themselves useless, in the sense that you should be creating enough structures that the company can function without you. And I think that's kind of the path we're on, which is increasingly, and especially in 2018, I've delegated a lot of the day-to-day stuff that I used to do, you know, even as you know, as late as last year, a lot of the stuff that I used to do last year, I don't do anymore. my role has completely changed as the CEO founder. And I think, you know, this is not an original concept, but I know a lot of other companies in not just in media, but in other sectors go through this transition where the founder's early role has to change. Otherwise, you know, you're artificially constricting your company.
The other thing I've seen you say is that the troubles in media are mostly about incompetence. The incompetence of people, and mostly men. What do you think? What's at the root of that incompetence? What does it look like to you?
Oh my God, this we can go on and on back and forth. But look, I think that, you know, 2017, 2018 has proved a lot of things in a larger context. The rise of Me Too movement and all that stuff sort of plays into this because. And, you know, where the state of the world that we're in today, whether in U.S. or even in your country in many ways, is a result of just either the hubris or the privilege of white men in general. Yeah. And there is a Ivy League circuit, particularly in New York, in media, that scratches each other's backs and people who... And I've said this in the past, which is that many Web 1.0 so-called pioneers in media came out of the pre-web world and in many ways inhibited the change that media needed to go through. And so time and again, you see people getting either, this is particularly talking about media startups, people getting funded because they fit a certain privileged network. And then, you know, when they implode, everybody says, oh, why did this happen? Well, guess what? This was bound to happen. So that's kind of, you know, there's so many other layers to it that we can talk about, but that's in essence what I mean by incompetence of people. And I've talked also in the past about failing upwards, and again, not a new phenomena, but we see tons of it. Tons of people failing upward in media that sort of jump from one failed venture to another or semi-failed venture to another, and turns out everybody, you know, when they start their next venture or they land somewhere else, everybody writes about them again and somehow expects things to be different.
It's like the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different outcome.
Yeah, so, you know, if and I think there's this is a thing we talked about initially. You know, one of my existence is to show that there's another way of doing things outside of the mainstream, outside of the scale-based media. Yeah. And hopefully, yeah. You know, if I do have an evangelizing function, that is my evangelizing function.
You're not a fan of scale these days, are you?
Well, I mean, can you blame me for
no.
that? I've only been shouting this for, I don't know, 15 years. And so all the troubles that we're in today, if I can humbly say so, I've been talking about for a while. You know, we went through a bit of our own journey at Skift early on where we were on a bit of a train to raise more money and scale because that's what I thought the investors needed to hear. And then when we got off that train early, you know, we launched in 2012 and we got off that train in 2014. So in a mini way, we went through that transition. It was a painful transition. I've talked about this in the past. We were 2 months away from running out of money. And then we turned the company around from there. So a lot of these things I've been talking about for a long time and I've gone through mini versions of these. And hopefully that, if it helps other people, then, you know, so be it.
Why did you see that and other people don't?
One of the things I've said is that, and so I've been on this journey for the last, actually all of 2018, on reading this business history book. So I've discarded, unfortunately, Twitter is still my addiction, which I love and hate, but that's pretty much everybody in media. But outside of that, I've cut watching any TV shows or podcasts, et cetera, focus just on books, specific kind of books, business history books, with the idea that you then realize that everything that happens in the world, in business particularly, happens in cycles. And if you are a student of cycles, you're able to understand and see a lot of things. you and I go back a bit, and then we realize, well, stuff that happened in the early days of publishing in AOL ecosystem, back when AOL mattered 15, 20 years ago, and the power that it held over publishers. In many ways, 20 years later, that's Facebook or Google. And so you're able to join those dots on a longer term horizon that, you know, certainly people who are not inclined to look at business cycles don't get to see. And so in many ways, being a student of connecting dots across the world so I'm answering your first part of the question, which is why am I able to see it? That's the answer, hopefully. And hopefully I never lose that ability. As for why others don't see it, I just, you know, many of them are in it because it seems like the cool thing to do. Many of them are in it because that's the startup ecosystem. And this is not just in media, this is across sectors in the startup world, which is that you raise a certain amount, then, you know, it's written that you're supposed to raise another round, then you raise another round. So it just becomes this cycle. And whether the pressure from investors is conscious or unconscious, pressure from investors is in many cases not direct, but it's indirect. Meaning, if you raise money, everything tells you that you have to give returns to investors at a certain, you know, at a certain valuation. So a lot of it then becomes indirect, implicit pressure on you to scale. And that then turns into this whole cycle where you have to you become everything for everyone.
We close every interview by asking about a piece of media that's impacted you most recently. It could be a book or an article, a movie, a podcast, or a business history book, as you've just described. What would you recommend?
Yeah, I have a list on Goodreads, which I'm happy to send over. But
oh, wow, great.
I read this book in July called The Land of Desire and the Rise of the New American Culture. Fascinating book on the rise of how consumer culture came into U.S. and particularly how department stores came. This is early 1900s history, and it's fascinating because a lot of the stuff that because I'm, you know, my family's from India, I see a lot of that relatively new consumer desire in India and other parts of the world, and how that was manufactured in U.S. and then repeated in the UK and other parts of Europe, and the manufacturing of desire that in many ways, I suppose, has happened in the internet again and again.
So we know we overload you with information every single week, but we're just going to pound a couple of those buttons again right at the end of the show. We are launching a report. Please do RSVP if you want to come to the launch event, which is taking place in November. There's a link to RSVP in the newsletter. Also, speaking of the newsletter, do you know we do a newsletter?
We've got a newsletter.
So it goes out every week, and it contains everything that we've spoken about on the podcast, plus links to what we're reading and links out to the transcriptions that we do for all our interviews. And also, if you do want to follow us on social, you can find us on Twitter at Media Voices Pod, or I'm at Chris M. Sutcliffe. It's probably worth hitting that again.
I'm at Esther Keziah T.
I'm at Flipping_Pages. I had to think really hard about that.
It's been a while since we did it. But until next week, when we are going to be back with another fantastic guest and another whirlwind tour through all the media news and views, thanks very much for listening, and goodbye.
Ta-ta.